loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, New York City residents protested Amazon so much that the company decided not to put its second headquarters there. Next, the Spanish Prime Minister called for snap elections. Then, within the fight against gentrification nationwide, we profile the fight against a slumlord's nasty intimidation tactics right here in Washington. And then we discuss China's investments in Venezuela. And finally, our last interview of the hour, as always, is the worst headlines of the week. But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. Today is Susan B. Anthony Day, a day to celebrate women's suffrage and to commemorate the birth of one of the most important leaders in the history of that movement. So far, six states celebrate Susan B. Anthony Day, which is not yet recognized on a national level. Congress blocked the sale of weapons to Turkish President Erdogan's security team until action is taken against the security agents charged with assaulting U.S. protesters in 2017. Congress also required a report from the Defense Department on the consequences of Turkey receiving a Russian S-400 missile system, and until then, the delivery of American F-35 jets has been blocked. A suicide car bombing targeting members of India's paramilitary Central Reserve Police Force killed more than 40 soldiers yesterday. Today, the diplomatic fallout continues as India blames Pakistan for facilitating the attack. The bombing took place in the disputed region of Kashmir, where there's a long-standing insurgency demanding either independence or unification with Pakistan. Bill Weld, the former Republican governor of Massachusetts, announced that he is considering a primary challenge to Donald Trump next year. Weld said, quote, "Our president is simply too unstable to carry out the duties of the highest executive office in the land," unquote. Weld is widely considered to be a libertarian Republican politically. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to New York City and Amazon. Amazon yesterday abruptly announced that it was canceling plans to open a second headquarters site in the New York City borough of Queens. The move came amid what the company said was an unexpected backlash from lawmakers, union leaders, and progressives angry over huge tax breaks and incentives that the state had offered the company. We're joined from New York by Gabby Silva. She's an organizer with Damayan and the Scamazon Coalition, as well as a resident of Queens. Welcome to the show, Gabby.
Hi, great to be here.
Gabby, as it turns out, Governor Cuomo put his reputation on the line for this deal and offered up more than $3 billion in incentives for the company. He forced this through the system, and there was indeed a backlash. Was this backlash because this really was a bad deal from the beginning? It was only going to create jobs that were going to last a decade or decade and a half or whatever it was supposed to be. Or is this a resurgent left, which is what the New York Times is saying?
I really believe it's the latter. We had the good fortune of working with this incredible coalition made up of Queens organizations who were very clear that there was no deal, no version of this deal that would convince us to allow Amazon to come to New York City, which is incredibly powerful. And I think is very clear that the people were strong in their politics, strong in their opposition, and that there's a lot of promise to continue building, which we need because the fight isn't over. In Staten Island, the workers are pushing to unionize. There's talks of a warehouse opening in the Bronx. So this is an amazing victory that we're all so proud of, but we're still going to keep at it.
Gabby Silva is our guest. Gabby is an organizer with Damayan and the Scamazon Coalition, as well as a resident of Queens. We had big, powerful political forces at play here, Gabby. We had, of course, the governor, Governor Cuomo, Mayor de Blasio. Governor Cuomo even said he would rename himself Amazon Cuomo. They gave Amazon a promise of $3 billion in tax breaks. They went over the top, pandering to Amazon. And at the end of the day, Amazon said, okay, because there's opposition, we're marching right out of here. It seems to me, when you think about this in the big picture, one, New Yorkers need billions of dollars of help. In other words, don't give it to the biggest corporation, the richest man in the world. Give it to help the subways, help affordable housing, help job training, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, this is a demonstration of muscle on the part of Amazon to all the other cities of the country. If you dare challenge us. If you dare complain about the fact that we're getting all of this money, we'll just shut you down. And it seems to me like taking political processes and politicians and whole communities hostage. I mean, I think it really is that. Go ahead.
Without a doubt, the residents of Queens were very, very clear that there was outrage that this deal was trying to be, you know, pushed, imposed on us without any sort of input or involvement from the community. And it really was just like a show among local politicians. And now, even more frustratingly, is that the media is trying to portray this as, you know, a victory of local politicians, right? That their opposition was what won this, was what pushed Amazon out. But in fact, they've been back and forth. You know, they've said, you know, we'll come to the table with Amazon if there is a different deal, a different version of this deal. And that's not what the people were calling for at all. Pretty much unanimously, New Yorkers were saying, you know, those billions of dollars, those incentives, it's really a slap in the face to us all when we've been calling for, you know, NYCHA repairs, repairs to the MTA.
That's really a critical issue. So there's this $3.2 billion that had been promised to Amazon. So clearly the state has $3.2 billion. What are they going to do with it? Are they going to try to upgrade the subway? Are they going to try to address homelessness or, you know, any of the problems related to poverty in the city? What are they going to do with that money?
We were very clear from the start when the deal was announced to issue a statement, not just calling for Amazon out, but calling for affordable housing, making that a right. I don't know if you know, Queens saw the highest rent increase last year in the entire country. We called for an end to union busting, the protection of NYCHA in particular, which the city's been threatening to privatize. So it was much bigger than, you know, just keeping Amazon out. It was like having a plan and a vision and calling for accountability from the city to make sure that they're investing in us in the ways that we want, right? Calling for the things that we've long needed.
Gabby Silva is our guest. Again, we have a situation where, and this speaks to the larger issue of jobs in America, because the promise from Amazon was to provide, quote, 25,000 jobs, close quote. Again, it was only until the year 2028. So it's actually less than a decade. And those jobs that's not people from Queens going to be hired. Those jobs could be coming in from outside. And there's no ironclad contract that Amazon has about these 25,000 jobs. And then if Amazon decides, well, guess what? Because you complained, you New Yorkers, you complained about the tax giveaways to Amazon, we're going to leave. That means that thus you're losing these jobs. It is, as we've discussed before, the tyranny of capital. The tyranny of corporate America, where they decide, their decisions are made of whether average people, meaning the people, get to work or not. And here you have a situation where it's New York City, powerful political forces at play, able to give $3 billion to Amazon. It seems to me, Gabby, that this will stimulate a larger struggle now, demanding that there be a real jobs program for all the things that you mentioned, whether it's the metro. Whatever the problems are that need fixing in New York, those are also jobs that people need.
The city is making it seem as though they needed this corporate middleman to accomplish any of these things, right? That this is the only way that these jobs can be brought to the city, that these training opportunities, and that's just an outright lie, you know? And I think you're absolutely right in saying that the people are very aware that it's absurd to make us think that we have to choose between accepting few jobs for local people, which while the vast majority of the jobs go to, you know, high level tech workers from elsewhere, right? Because in their memorandum, you're right, there was no actual concrete promise that these jobs would go to any New Yorkers. But also, you know, recognizing that Amazon has a long history of being anti-worker and anti-immigrant with their collaborations with ICE. So it was really incredible to hear people say, you know, we don't just want jobs and we don't want false promises of work. We want good work, right? We want the ability to unionize. We want our protections as workers, and Amazon won't do that for us. And the city has the power to, and they're choosing not to. And people saw right through that, which was incredible.
What are some of the big infrastructure issues? Let's go back to it again for people who aren't in New York City, don't know. Obviously, millions and millions of people depend on the infrastructure, the subways, the bridges, the roads, the schools.
which is in trouble. You know, people complain, not just here in the States, but internationally, that here's the most, arguably, the most important city in the world, and they have among the worst airports in the world of any major city.
Go ahead, Gabby.
The people have been calling for improvements to infrastructure for years and years and years, right? And you're right, the world is watching, and it's really kind of an embarrassment to the city to be, right, the most important, the richest city, this, that, and the other, and suffering from like a crumbling infrastructure. And of course, the working people are the ones that bear the brunt of that, right? Whether it's, you know, dealing with the MTA, which is truly unsafe. Our schools are just severely underfunded. You're talking about serious health violations and conditions in housing. So I think this Amazon struggle is really illuminating that even more. And as we mentioned earlier, really setting the stage for a broader struggle, which is so exciting to be a part of. So I think most people recognize this as a victory, but just the start. We need to continue putting pressure on politicians to really make right and make these promises, these empty promises, actually true, right? To give us the kind of city infrastructure that we deserve, because now we see that the money is there, right? And we've known the money is there.
Mayor de Blasio has tried to put himself at the forefront of this fight against Amazon, and it looks like he's taking some political advantage of it. Now, of course, it was a sort of a coalition of progressives and union members and some political figures, I'm very proud to say, including State Senator Michael Gennaris, a proud Greek American. But anyway, de Blasio wants to be seen as the guy who took down Amazon. Is that because he really wanted to take down Amazon for the better of the city, or because he wants to run for president?
I will be very frank. De Blasio had little to nothing to do with this this victory, with this struggle. In fact, he was very pro-Amazon. And now he's just trying to cover his behind.
There it is.
And I think definitely for the sake of future elections, and to still see, to try to be favorable in the eyes of New Yorkers.
I think you're right. We will leave it there. We were joined from New York by Gabby Silva. She's an organizer with Damayan and the Scamazon Coalition, as well as a resident of Queens. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has called a snap general election for April, continuing a period of turmoil as the territorial conflict over Catalonian independence continues to weigh on the country's politics. Sanchez suffered a major defeat earlier this week as opposition parties banded together to defeat his budget. The new election is expected to reveal even further fragmentation of the country's political landscape. We're joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome, Walter.
Happy to be here.
Walter, was this expected? We talked just a few days ago on this show about the possibility of an election being called. Did Sanchez expect to lose this budget vote, and why did it collapse his government so quickly?
Well, from the very beginning of Pedro Sanchez's government, the prime minister of Spain, you know, it's been very weak and fragile because it's a minority government. The Spanish Socialist Workers Party, which is just a mainstream center-left party, that's the prime minister's party, but it doesn't have a majority in parliament. In fact, it doesn't have even close to a majority in parliament, so it had to make an alliance not just with Podemos, which is the political party that came out of, you know, what was essentially the Spanish version of the Occupy movement. It actually happened before the Occupy movement in the United States, you know, is a left-wing party. So they made an alliance with them and also with a number of regional parties. The Spanish political system is federalized. There are lots of different regions, many of which speak different languages or, you know, different dialects of Spanish. And so the parties in the Catalonia region, which tried to hold an independence referendum in 2017, which was brutally repressed by the Spanish police, they were also, you know, part of that grouping of parties that allowed Pedro Sanchez to form a government in the first place to get a majority in parliament. Well, because what they say, and I think is, you know, essentially a show trial, a political trial going on of the leaders of that independence vote, right? I mean, these are top level Catalan political leaders who are being imprisoned and now hauled in front of a court on, you know, very serious charges, facing many years in prison. those regional parties said, no, you know what, we're not going to vote for your budget, which is what caused the government to collapse. We won't give you the majority that you need to pass this essential piece of legislation. And so Pedro Sanchez was in a position where he had no other choice but to call new elections, which I believe will be the third Spanish general election in less than 4 years.
The most important thing, the most important reason that that this happened really is because of Catalonia and the vote for Catalonian independence, which has been hanging over the government for a long time, about a year and a half now. What does this do for Catalonian independence? Does it do anything? Is there a danger of a farther right-wing party coming to power that could make things even worse for Catalonian politicians or for those Catalonians who supported independence?
Well, that is a distinct possibility, I think. The Spanish political landscape has gone through, you know, pretty substantial changes. You know, the parliamentary democracy was reintroduced in the country following the end of the fascist Franco dictatorship in 1978. There was a new constitution. There are democratic elections. And basically, there was a two-party system with a couple of smaller additions. But, you know, there was basically no doubt that either the center-left, you know, the Socialist Workers' Party, or the right-wing party, the People's Party, would form a government. And they would usually have like a majority of legislators to do so, especially. And I think the trigger of it was really the economic crisis, the global economic crisis, which was, you know, in some ways, you know, worse in Europe because of indebtedness. You know, there was horrible austerity imposed on working people in Spain, largely at the behest of the European Union, European Central Bank, and the right wing political parties in Spain, and also the Spanish Socialist Workers Party, the center left party as well. And so, you know, that immediately led to the creation of the Podemos movement as a consequence of the mass protest movement in the street against these types of austerity measures. But on the right wing of the political spectrum, there are also a couple newcomers that make it, you know, conceivable, certainly, that there could be a right wing coalition that would be completely militantly opposed to any type of self-determination for people in the Catalonia region or for, you know, any of the other, you know, regions of Spain that have sort of their own ethnicity, nationality. One is the Citizens Party, which emerged sort of like, well, we're the non-corrupt version of the People's Party, the mainstream conservative party. But then it sort of quickly tried to fill the void in the political spectrum sort of the far right. And, you know, the primary vehicle for that was opposition to Catalan independence. And then there's a party that, I mean, truly, truly is of the extreme right wing, and that's called Vox. They came out of nowhere, really. They just won their first seat in the regional parliament. They don't have anybody in the national parliament. But if the opinion polls are right, I mean, they could score, you know, double-digit vote percentages, yeah, in this election now. So for the first time since the end of the Franco era, there'll be sort of an extreme right-wing party represented in Spanish national politics.
Something we've seen elsewhere around Europe, whether it's Italy or Greece or France or several of the Eastern European countries, is the resurgence of this right wing. So does this election do anything for the Catalonian leaders who have been imprisoned and who are currently on trial? Does it matter for them who ends up becoming prime minister? And the reason I ask that is because public opinion polls in Spain show that most Spaniards do not want them to be prosecuted, or if they are to be prosecuted, they do not want them to receive lengthy prison sentences.
And they're facing, as
oh,
Walter
decades,
mentioned,
20, decades.
25 years in prison each for having
for
a referendum.
Independence, yeah.
Again, though, let's just put it in. I want you to answer John's question, Walter, but then I have a follow-up question. Go ahead.
Well, to answer John's question, I think that, you know, there's hopes that the Sanchez government would be less hardline than the Rajoy government, who was in charge of the Spanish central government when the referendum was actually being held and riot police were going in and beating people up. That didn't really happen, right? I mean, this trial went forward. Now the Sanchez government, you know, their line is like, well, look, the judiciary is independent. We can't do anything about it. But I don't think that's how government or power generally works. So the right-wing government, I mean, they could be worse in certain respects, but I think that, you know, the decisive thing is really going to be what happens in the mass movement in Catalonia. I mean, earlier this week, we were talking to Dick Nichols from Barcelona, who told us about, you know, massive demonstrations that were being planned, including a general strike by pro-independence workers. So I think that could have a big impact on the situation. The only sort of like all Spanish part, like all Spain party that supports the right to decide, not which is different than independence.
Meaning the right to have a vote about self-determination, but not necessarily advocacy for it.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So it's an alliance called Unidos Podemos, which is basically the Podemos party, which came out of the Spanish Occupy movement, and the United Left, which is basically the electoral alliance led by the Communist Party of Spain.
Again, you know, people think of Spain as being a country with permanent borders. I mean, more or less.
Right.
So it seems kind of like, what's the big deal if Catalonia has an independence vote? But again, just in our own recent history, borders have changed and countries have changed. I mean, the Soviet Union was a multinational state. It dissolved in 1991 and had brand new borders. I mean, all of those different republics besides Russia became independent countries. Yugoslavia was a united country, a multinational country like Spain in some ways. It broke apart under pressure from NATO. Czechoslovakia was a country. Today, we have Czech, the Czech Republic, and Slovakia. You could easily see how, say, in Canada, Quebec could become its own country. It's certainly about 25% of the Canadian gross national product. Barcelona, the center of Catalonia, Catalonia is about 26, 27% of Spain's overall economy. It could exist as a country. So you can also see that there is the centrifugal force of the modern European political reality. In other words, countries' borders changing. So it becomes less abstract when you think about it in that sense. And the question is why?
I think that the economic factor is kind of at the center of all of this. I mean, the sort of political unity of the, you know, quote unquote European project was really burst apart by the, you know, debt crisis and ensuing austerity regime that was imposed on people all across the continent. There's a number of other, I mean, there's sort of the big picture geopolitical things that are going on in the world. You know, maybe there's less confidence in Donald Trump, and then there's the rise of all these far right wing parties, which I think were, you know, fundamentally also a consequence of the economic crisis and basically the leading role of the social democratic, mainstream social democratic parties in imposing all this hardship on working people in the first place. So I think there's a number of issues at play here. But as a consequence, you know, the actual state structures of a lot of these countries are becoming weaker. And so these longstanding independence movements, right, because there's been movements for Catalan independence for, I mean, some people would argue centuries. I mean, certainly at least, you know, since the beginning of the 20th
17th,
century.
17th, 18th, 19th, mm-hmm. 20th century rebellions. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there's lots of these things that exist in countries all across the world. I mean, I think pretty much... the vast majority of countries are, you know, while they're one country with one government, one set of border, there are many, you know, people might think of themselves as nationalities within those borders, right? People who have distinct languages and cultures might live in the same general area. Those are two different things. And there are different, you know, aspirations that people have for self-determination. That can take on lots of different political characters. It can be right wing, it can be left wing, it can be progressive, it can be, you know, revolutionary. But, you know, there is this sort of like fundamental desire for self-expression and determination.
Yeah, and the nation state didn't always exist. I mean, this is something from the last mm-hmm. couple hundred years, of course. And now there are multilateral states and institutions like the EU. But guess what? The UK, a principal part of the EU, getting divorced. Again, we see a lot of centrifugal forces at play in the world. We're going to come back to this story because we want to understand what's going on in Spain, what's going on in Catalonia, but what's going on across Europe, because its implications are pretty profound.
Well, we will leave it there. We were happy to be joined here in the studio by our friend Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A Washington, D.C. developer has resorted to intimidation and displacement tactics to force residents from their homes in the city's Brooklyn Manor development. Developer Mid-City Financial stands to receive $47 million to reduce the affordable housing stock and increase the number of luxury units available in Northeast Washington. And the company is using hardball tactics to do that. It turns out it's a national trend. We're joined from Washington by Yasmina Marabit. She's a housing organizer with LinkUp, a community group organizing with tenant associations around the city. Welcome, Yasmina.
Thank you for having me.
Yasmina, this Washington situation at Brooklyn Manor is a microcosm, I think, of what's happening nationwide. Here on the show, we've even talked about Jared Kushner being a slumlord and owning places in Baltimore and in New York that are just in terrible states of disrepair. Tell us a little bit about what's happening in Washington, but also what's happening on a broader scale around the country.
Yeah, I think what's happening in Washington is reflective of what's happening around the country. I mean, when it comes to slumlords and slum conditions on properties, it's a model that works so well for developers. Basically, they can allow the properties to deteriorate. They allow the properties to deteriorate. They maximize profits by collecting rents and then not paying out for any maintenance costs.
Yeah.
And then when the time is right, all they have to do is, you know, sell the property and then it gets redeveloped. And then, you know, we know the huge profits that follow. So it's just one of many tactics that developers use to push low-income people around, basically, in accordance with what will generate profit.
We've heard about different tactics that these slumlords are using in Washington, things like not making repairs, as you mentioned. But we're also hearing about not allowing people free movement outside the building, where it's almost impossible to get in or out of your building because of, well, purported construction projects. Tell us a little bit about what you see around D.C.
Yeah, so there are a lot of different tactics that are used. I mean, we've seen tactics such as the use of private security companies to enforce rules on properties that are put out by the property management companies. And basically, they enforce those rules by saying, well, if you break these little community rules, then you have a notice of infraction on your record. Once you get a notice of infraction on your record, then you can that can be grounds for possible eviction. So that's a tactic where developers can use, that's a tactic that developers can use to really run mass eviction campaigns. They also do things like erect fences around properties, block tenants from, you know, like at Brooklyn Manor, there are barbed wire fences around all of the grassy areas that are in front and behind the buildings. So kids, for example, can't go outside and play in the grass. There's a picture included on the LinkUp website in the most recent blog that was posted where you can see the barbed wire fences that are blocking the grass. And then they were doing construction on, well, they were repairing cracks in the sidewalk in front of one of the buildings. And so the people were trapped in the building until the concrete dried because they couldn't just walk out and walk through the grass because it was blocked off by the fences. And then they couldn't walk out onto the sidewalk because there was caution tape up and wet concrete.
That's amazing. I'm looking at the photo right now. It's on the linkupitsofficial.org website. And it's an article by you, Yasmina. Developer Mid-City Financial continues intimidation of residents at Brooklyn Manor. And you can see the photo for yourself. Again, yeah, people are actually imprisoned in their apartments. And this is designed, Yasmina, to make life hard or to compel people, or hopefully from the point of view of the developer to get, or the landlord to get people to decide, well, I can't live here. It's unbearable. And then people move, and that changes the equation. Let's talk about other intimidation tactics. I heard from one of our producers that one of the landlords was naming plaintiffs in a class action lawsuit. In other words, trying to intimidate other people. What's that about? And what are the tenants' options?
Well, okay, so that's a tactic that that Mid-City has used at Brooklyn Manor. Mid-City Financial Corporation is the developer. And basically, when tenants have decided to become active in the organizing campaign, in the most recent case, this was through becoming a named plaintiff on a familial status discrimination lawsuit that's outstanding against the developer. The developer sent out a letter to every household on the property that basically said, you know, there's one of your neighbors, and named the household, the head of the household, and said that they're delaying your ability to access your new apartments with amenities, and I don't remember what other stuff they said with it, but basically, you know, this household is the reason why you can't access your new apartments, even though the new apartments will by and large be luxury, unaffordable apartments that hundreds of families in the community will not have access to. And not only that, but the redevelopment is not going to bring back the large bedroom size units, which many families in the community need. So it's like, you know, they're selling this false narrative that the affordable housing needs of the community will be met when they absolutely will not be met. And, you know, even in the letter that they sent out to every household, it says, we want to remind you one more time that everyone that is in good standing will be able to live in the on the property after the redevelopment. But they have never, to this day, they have refused to say what quote unquote in good standing even means. You know, you could have a notice of infraction on your record and not be in good standing. You could have paid your rent late once and not be in good standing. Maybe they're going to run your credit. Who knows? But they won't tell.
And the whole point of this, too, is to push people out so that they can forcibly gentrify this neighborhood and sell units and make money. And they don't care where the rest of these people go.
Yasmina, I lived here in the 1980s. I went back to New York City for almost 20 years, came back in the last decade. The character of the city has profoundly changed. When I left in 1990, the city was by a large majority African-American. Today, that's no longer the case. I mean, this is a very short amount of time where gentrification constitutes both, I would say, like a class war against working class communities, but it's really also a class war against black communities in particular because of the issue of so-called race and class correspond here in the nation's capital.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they have developed a very like efficient and effective method of displacing the working poor. I mean, the developers are working hand in hand with the politicians, and then they have law enforcement that can, you know, enforce things on the ground. You know, you have like the entire political establishment in Washington is complicit in this process, and they are, in fact, the functionaries of the developers. So Mayor Bowser, for instance, who considers herself the most progressive mayor on the East Coast, has led the way for the mass privatization of the public housing stock in D.C. through her so-called New Communities Initiative. And in the case of Brooklyn Manor, where, again, the developer Mid-City plans to reduce the affordable housing stock and increase the luxury housing stock, the mayor is the one who introduced a public financing plan, which was unanimously approved by all of the district city council members to give Mid-City $47 million in public financing, not to increase, you know, the number of affordable units that they were going to add as a part of their redevelopment, but rather to underwrite their existing plan, which reduces the affordable housing, eliminates almost all the large family bedroom sizes, and triples density with almost all luxury efficiencies, one and two bedroom.
The fix is in, really. And it doesn't matter how often politicians tell you that they're progressive. What matters is their actions. And actions like this tell me that Muriel Bowser had made her mind up in the very beginning that she was going to allow this neighborhood to gentrify.
Yeah, let's go back in our last 90 seconds or so, because where we started, it's a national trend. Is there a national solution? I mean, obviously, God did not mandate a particular system of dispersing and distributing and access for housing in this country or any country. Where should the country be going, Yasmina?
Well, in the exact opposite direction that it's going right now. Rather than privatizing all of the public housing and doing away with, you know, a public option, what we should have is publicly owned and controlled housing, affordable housing that's publicly owned and controlled, that is not, you know, managed and run by these private entities that are driven solely by profit. We need a public option. We need, you know, social housing, and we need a public option that's not public housing the way that we've seen it, you know, in the United States, where it's allowed to fall into complete, you know, disarray. It needs to be state-of-the-art, beautiful public housing with green space and community centers and sports facilities. And that's all possible if we took all of this money that we're giving away to these private entities so that they can profit. Rather, we could take that money and put it into building a public infrastructure, or the public infrastructure that we would need to make a public option available.
Yeah, there's no reason public housing can't be excellent housing, beautiful housing, green housing, open space housing. The caricature, the stereotype of the existing public housing is such that the dominant narrative is the only way you can have decent housing is by private landlords. The opposite is the case, especially for working class communities.
We're out of time, so we'll have to leave it there. We were joined from Washington by Yasmina Morabit. She's a housing organizer with LinkUp, a community group organizing with tenant associations around the city. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Wall Street Journal reported yesterday that the Chinese government is in talks with the Venezuelan opposition to safeguard its investments in the country. The journal says that Chinese economic officials are worried about the $20 billion that Venezuela owes China, as well as its investments in the Venezuelan oil industry. Chinese officials, however, called the reports fake news and said that no such discussions had taken place. This is just one front in the global battle for control of Venezuela's oil assets following U.S.-backed Juan Guaido's appointment of parallel boards of directors for the country's main petroleum corporations. We'll discuss all of this with Andy Brennan. He's a journalist with Asia Times and CGTN, and he joins us from Beijing. Welcome back, Andy.
Good to be back.
Andy, can you explain to us the overall, sort of an overall view of China's economic interests in Venezuela? I think this is something that most Americans really have no idea about.
I delved a little deep into this as well, and I'm really surprised at how much the Chinese are actually involved. To give it just brief context, if I may, all the way back in 1996, Venezuela's trade, all of the Asia-Pacific, was barely $1 billion. It was $1.2 billion. And the majority of that, like $700 million, was with Japan. And then in around 2001, former President Hugo Chavez entered into what the Chinese love using in all the documents, a strategic development partnership with then Chinese President Jiang Zemin. And then they instilled in 2004 a very interesting little agreement, which is still working today. And it allowed both countries to make investments without having to pay taxes to the treasury of the other country. And because of this, Chinese investment absolutely poured into Venezuela like never before. More than 20 different companies from China began operating in areas of oil, of course, but also railroad construction, mining, infrastructure, telecommunications, agriculture. And then not long after that, former President Hugo Chavez announced the suspension of Venezuela's traditional military cooperation with the United States, which led the U.S. to lose their access to the port of I think it's called Fortaleza. It looks like Hugo Chavez had found a new patron, and that was what he thought was China. In 2007, the Chinese and the Venezuelans established what they called the Joint Fund, and Chavez is the one who initiated it. And it allowed Venezuela to receive loans from China in tranches of about $5 billion and repay them back as in collateral shipments of crude oil. And so far, the only bank able to do this within China is the Development Bank of China. And it granted the Venezuelan government somewhere in between, we're not fully sure, because the numbers are kept kind of secret, but between $37 and $42.5 billion in a five-year period from 2007 until 2012. And at the time, that was like 60% of all the loans to Latin America. And the figures have never been revealed, so the estimates swing about that Chinese have granted and gifted to, with loans, conditional obviously, to Venezuela between $50 and $70 billion. And when the oil prices tanked in 2014 and the Chinese saw that it was going to be very difficult for the Venezuelans to pay back the oil because they had to export more and more, they relaxed the terms of an agreement which removed the minimum quantity of oil sent, which was previously 330,000 barrels of oil to China per day, which is astounding. And it also allowed the Chinese also allowed the Venezuelans to pay not in US dollars, but in the Bolivar, and altered the loan tranches. But Maduro, when Maduro came to power, he went looking for more and more bailouts. And he got a $4 billion cash deal in July 2014 and another one in April 2015, but it was worth $5 billion. So that was $9 billion more in the space of a year. But the Chinese then grew cautious. And I went and I looked this up, and I found a few scholars, prominent ones in China, they were warning about, quote, guarding against bad debts. So in 2016, China stopped issuing loans to Venezuela. And in 2018, because Caracas hadn't diversified its economy and the oil payments to China went into arrears, Caracas sold to China between 9.9 and 10% of the joint venture of Sinovensa to the China National Petroleum Corporation, if I remember correctly, which is a state-owned enterprise. And that percentage, combined with the percentage of shares already owned by China National Petroleum Corporation, equates to 49% of the oil venture ownership. In other words, the oil John Bolton wants well, China is in possession of a lot of the drilling and production of it. And this, coupled with being in charge of the extraction of the oil and doubling the production to send 1 million barrels to China, it also being a large provider of arms to Venezuela and still being owed, like the Wall Street Journal has reported, $20 billion, but some Chinese papers say $30 billion, means China has lots to lose. And considering Caracas is in debt of maybe $100 billion to foreign countries, China is its most prominent creditor and will not be dissuaded easily, but it is going to be very cautious in how it handles this. It wants to be more cautious than ever since it established about 790 projects in Venezuela since the agreements with Chavez, but most of them have actually failed due to debt defaults and, has to be said, some corruption. But besides oil, Venezuela is also very interested in the 200 estimated billion minerals, you know, just like it is interested in the minerals that are in North Korea, which it has good dealings with. It also has coltan, iron. And the Chinese actually worked out with the Venezuelans something called, and I never heard of it, excuse me, the Venezuelan mining map. And it mapped an area of 111,000 square kilometers of territory specifically to mine and find gold.
Let's reintroduce Andy Brennan is our guest here today.
Andy's a journalist with Asia Times and CGTN, and he joins us from Beijing. We're talking about Chinese investment in Venezuela. Andy, politically, the Chinese have been very clear that they support the government of the elected president, Nicolas Maduro. What would happen politically if Juan Guaido and his... Well, Juan Guaido, of course, was imposed on Venezuela by the United States. What would happen if Guaido actually is able to consolidate power? What would the Chinese have to do in order to protect their investments in the country?
I do think that there actually might be some real credibility to these reports that the Chinese have been meeting with the opposition. There's two sides to this. The first side is that they back Maduro. And when he visited China in 2018, Premier Li Qiang promised whatever help China could offer. And equally that year, Wang Yi said that the countries of the region are part of the natural extension of the maritime Silk Route and are indispensable. In other words, China wants it to be part of the BRI. And Beijing also is not only Venezuela's biggest creditor, but it does regard, or has for a long time, Venezuela as its staunchest ally in Latin America, especially with this rising right tide with what Chris Hedges calls the organized international right. But the Chinese leadership are methodical, and they've kind of pulled a little bit back from Venezuela. They really wanted to invest in Brazil and see it as a springboard, but they're going to wait and bide their time, as they usually do. However, with Juan Guaido, the thing we have to know about the Chinese is they value stability. This is what they value most of all. Now, they may fear Juan Guaido rethinks the loans and the projects and maybe replicates Mahathir bin Mohamed of Malaysia's rebuke of Chinese projects, which he deemed unnecessary or inflated. And they don't want that. And they equally don't want Guaido's total acquiescence to a U.S. monopoly, which would almost certainly lock out Beijing from Venezuela, solidify financial losses, potential mineral losses, the investment, the partial oil ownership in jeopardy, and it would, of course, lose face. So they will seek, I think, maybe to work with Guaido if he was to somehow get into power. I don't think he will. I think it's quite flagrant attempt at a coup. But the thing about the Chinese is they don't want to lose. It's about stability. And they will work maybe behind the scenes at both sides.
Andy Brennan, we saw yesterday at the United Nations, 50 countries standing behind the Venezuelan foreign minister announcing their solidarity with the Venezuelan government. It's certainly possible that there could be meetings between the Chinese government and Guaido, but anybody looking at this situation would have to come to the conclusion that if a U.S.-led coup by a U.S.-handpicked person who most Venezuelans had never heard about comes into power and he's promising to privatize all of Venezuela's oil, whatever existing contracts exist between the People's Republic of China and Venezuela will, I would say, most likely be ditched. I mean, there would be one way or another that it would happen. The United States will take control, I think, of Venezuela's oil if this were to succeed. 30 seconds left. You take us out.
I absolutely totally agree. And I do think while they will look for stability and play both sides, maybe they're not going to just sit back and not support Maduro. Chinese trade in Latin America has increased 22 times since 2000, and they were making real inroads. They very much don't like this right tide in Latin America or this pro-US sycophancy that could lock them out. And I see potentially their fear of being locked out of Latin America as this bifurcation of hegemonies from the United States come over. So they will try their best to support Maduro, but I think it will be, again, they might say, okay, we'll give you more loans. But they'll be fearful of that. But they'll definitely add political support if they can.
We're out of time. We were joined by Andy Brennan. He's a journalist with Asia Times and CGTN, and he joined us from Beijing. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again this week, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his site Left Eye on the News. You can find that at lefteye.blogspot.com. And you can find all the worst headlines that we don't have a chance to get to today. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog. We're joined here in the studio by Nicole Russell. She's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome to both of you.
Glad to be back.
Happy Friday, y'all.
Steve, we spent a good bit of time today on the show talking about Amazon. What we didn't talk about was a very funny headline related to Amazon. Let's start by talking about that.
Sure. This was an editorial in the New York Times, I think today, or maybe yesterday. And the headline, which I'm sure they intended to be slightly funny, reads, New York returns 25,000 jobs to Amazon. I suppose that's supposed to be a play on the idea that you buy things from Amazon and then you return them. But of course, it's a completely misleading headline because New York did not return 25,000 jobs to Amazon. Amazon held out the promise that they would create 25,000 jobs over the course of the next 20 years. There actually were no jobs, and New York didn't return any jobs to them. So it's how many of those jobs would have actually materialized is anybody's guess. But chances are it would have been much less than 25,000 because they always exaggerate these kind of numbers.
It speaks to the status of the country and the system that we live in, but sort of indirectly and not on purpose. The entities that have the ability to provide jobs, that is so that working people can work and thus be able to get money and thus be able to feed their families and have shelter, that right or that system is based on private employers rather than looking at a job as a right, as a human right. In other words, we have the right to vote. If you're homeless, you have the right to vote, but you don't have a right to a home. If you're unemployed, you have the right to vote every 2 or 4 years, but you don't have the right to a job. I mean, if the government has this much money to give to private corporations in the form of tax breaks, including the richest corporation in the world, why can't that money be used to guarantee people that right, the right to work?
Good question.
That is a great question, Brian. And the other thing I keep thinking about is, you know, this is such a victory that people stood in the streets and said, you know, housing is already unaffordable. Like, don't make it even so much worse that you will, you know, you will be making it worse if you bring Amazon to the city. They won that victory. And I heard somebody commenting about this as it came out. And their very first comment was, I feel so bad for all the investors who invested in, you know, Long Island and buying
nice
condos.
That's exactly what I was thinking today. Yes. Those poor investors.
Speculators have to be kicking themselves today.
Poor guys.
Those
man.
Poor landlords
using
and real estate
developers. Using housing for income instead of, you know, needing to live in it.
That's right.
Let's go on to the next headline.
Well, let's go back to Venezuela, which we talked about last week and the week before. But again, there's some horrible headlines in the news this week. And this is, I'm calling the worst headline of the week from the New York Times. U.S. sanctions are aimed at Venezuela's oil. Its citizens may suffer first. There's so much wrong with this headline, I hardly know where to begin. First of all, U.S. sanctions have been in place against Venezuela long before the most current sanctions against Venezuelan oil. Just to name one, they have been prohibited from repatriating profits from their Citgo, which is a U.S. company but owned by Venezuela, for a long time now, thanks to U.S. sanctions. So its citizens are already suffering from U.S. sanctions. There's no may about it whatsoever. But what's the really bad thing, the worst thing about this headline is the implicit idea that there's that sanctions are aimed at the oil or at the economy. They are not. Sanctions are always aimed at ordinary people aiming to make them suffer. That's the whole point of sanctions, to try to force the government out. And I have to read something. This is a classic proof of that statement. This is a 1960 State Department document about Cuba. And it's a long document, so I won't read the whole thing. But the bottom line says, every possible means should be undertaken promptly to weaken the economic life of Cuba. You could substitute Venezuela now. To bring about hunger, desperation, and overthrow of government. That's been the purpose of sanctions back in 1960 and continuing to this day against Cuba. And it's the purpose of sanctions against Iran, against North Korea, and it's the purpose of sanctions against Venezuela. So the idea that sanctions are aimed at Venezuela and they may hurt the people, that's just plain offensive.
I mean, this should be rewritten in a real way. U.S. sanctions have been going on for years, have been aimed at the people of Venezuela, and are now ending with the U.S. coup attempt in Venezuela. I mean, that's more of what is actually reality.
The New York Times, in the year after the overthrow of the Mossadegh government in Iran, that was 1953, the government was overthrown after it nationalized the Anglo-Iranian oil company, now known as BP. Then the United States imposed sanctions, and so did Britain, which really had possessed Iran's oil before it was nationalized. They imposed sanctions, and there was a lot of economic suffering. Iran's economy started to scream. The middle class started having anti-Mossadegh protests. The CIA and British intelligence moved in, overthrew the government, and imposed on the Iranian people the Shah of Iran, a monarch, a tyranny, a dictator. Afterwards, here's what the New York Times said. Underdeveloped countries with rich resources now have an object lesson in the heavy cost that must be paid by one of their number, which goes berserk with fanatical nationalism. That's the New York Times, the liberal New York Times, talking about a lesson has been learned. And of course, what that meant is that thousands of Iranians died. They not only lost their democracy, but a lot of people were killed. And the New York Times was crowing about it. So when we think about these headlines, think about the past, too, when the New York Times could speak more frankly.
So I suppose it's unsurprising that they wrote U.S. sanctions are aimed at Venezuela's oil and its citizens may suffer.
Yeah. I mean, I think they know. I think the New York Times actually knows the deal on the use of economic sanctions. It used to crow about them because it had the attended impact. It not only overthrew Mossadegh, but as they said, it provides an object lesson in the heavy cost that must be paid by one of their numbers, meaning people in developing countries who wanted to, quote, nationalize American or British companies. Go ahead, Steve. Next one.
I'm going to switch gears here to what sounds like a funny headline. It's really not, I would say. It's from the New York Times again. Crystal meth is North Korea's trendiest Lunar New Year's gift. Now, I'll preface what I'm going to say next by saying that, you know, this may be true. I have no idea. I'm not North Korea. I don't have the facts about what's going on in North Korea. But the question is, how does the New York Times know? And the answer is they don't, because the source of this article is that, quote, several anonymous sources told the U.S. government in the form of Radio Free Asia that this was the case. So even though the article itself admits that this can't be independently verified, but they still ran the headline that says it states it as a plain fact that this is true, that North Koreans are giving each other crystal meth for Lunar New Year's. It's just an offense to good journalism.
Wait, I thought the mainstream media thought that everyone in North Korea was on the brink of starvation. That doesn't mesh with their.
I don't know, Steve, why you're being cautious about whether this is a true or untrue story.
So
what accounts for your caution here? I mean, this story originates from Radio Free Asia, which is, you know, like American intelligence radio. And it also, the other source comes from South Korea, meaning South Korean intelligence.
It is true that every story that's ever originated with those sources has proven to be false. That's a fact.
Yeah, everyone.
Like all North Koreans have to have the same haircut as Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, I remember that one.
And his ex-girlfriend was executed with anti-artillery fire,
yes,
because his current wife was jealous, except his ex-girlfriend is, she's doing concerts in North Korea. Oh, well, let's go on to the next story.
Let's go back. Let's go to Robert Reich. This is an article from Truthdig, but Robert Reich gets it's republished in various places. America is a socialist country for the rich. Well, America is, I'd call it a kleptocracy for the rich, not a socialist country. The whole Reich's definition, the whole article rests on the statement that in the conservative mind, socialism means getting something for doing nothing. Well, why is he letting these reactionary conservatives define what socialism means? That's not what socialism means at all. But
okay, but here, wait. I want to jump in on this one. I think what Reich is talking about, and we have 1 minute left, is that people think about socialism versus capitalism like this. One is a government a run economy, and one is the free market or private market. I think the point he's making is that the government also is intervening in the so-called free market economy, the capitalist economy, but doing all of the subsidizing and giving all of the assistance to the already very rich, to the corporations and to the banks. They're bailing them out. So it's a kind of government intervention or a kind of socialism, meaning it's something good, but in this case, it's only for the already affluent. Isn't that really what he means? Jump in, Nicole. What do you think?
Yeah, that's definitely what he means. And, you know, absolutely. But that's what we've seen, right? People don't get free housing, which is something they need, but the banks get a bailout from the government. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, Steve's right that it's not a good definition of socialism, but I actually know what Reich means.
Yes, indeed. Well, we were joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Steve Patt. Steve's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his site Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefti.blogspot.com. You can also find all the worst headlines that we didn't get to. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog. And here in the studio, we were joined by Nicole Russell. She's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear. Thank you.